And he's going to tell us about some Feynman diagrams in algebra.
He wants you to start.
Did you start?
Yes, yes.
Good. So I'm taping this because I tend to tape all my lectures because 10% of them are worth preserving, but you don't know in advance which ones it will be. And I think it's a good idea. You should be taping all the lectures. So, you know, sometimes you want to see something back. Anyway, I will tell you about how Feynman diagrams appear in a pure algebra context in a very simple way. And then I will tell you with very little detail how it's used to construct some really well-behaved, quite powerful, and polytime computable knot invariants. So, I mean, if you're in knot theory, this is sort of a dream. The cost is that it's actually a bit complicated at the end. Please take copies of the handout. Good. And I should say that everything is joined with Roland van der Veen. Here's a picture. And thank you for inviting me to UCLA. And also that I should say that the acronym Omega Epsilon Beta means this. And there are some links during the presentation. You can watch them. And also the handout itself is over there, and the video will be there. And I hope you're all holding a handout, and here's what it looks like. And let me start. So first of all, the PBW principle. So if you know the PBW theorem from Lie theory, do you know? Can I use it? It basically says, well, it says that the universal enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra is isomorphic to its symmetric algebra, namely the algebra of polynomials with generators, the generators of the Lie algebra, except it's a vector space isomorphism, not an algebra isomorphism. So from the perspective of the polynomial ring, the multiplication in the algebra is not the ordinary multiplication, it's a funny multiplication. But you see, multiplication is a map from the polynomial ring tensor itself into the polynomial ring. But the polynomial ring tensor, a polynomial ring, is again a polynomial ring. So multiplication is a map from one polynomial ring to another. And then the moral is that if you want to understand lots and lots of algebras, you first want to understand arbitrary linear maps between polynomial algebras. Now, you think this is second grade material, or first year material, because, you know, in linear algebra 1, you'll teach your students, okay, here's polynomials up to degree 5, let's differentiate, what's the matrix representing differentiation? You think you know it well, but it's false, because really, I'm talking about the whole polynomial ring, which has infinitely many generators, maps into another one that has infinitely many. There is an infinite amount of information there. So in principle, it's not even computable. How do you even present this information? So I'm going to tell you how to do it in cases that are relevant for this. Before I continue, a gentle agreement is that everything converges, so don't ask me why certain power series converge. I'll just say that convergence is always in the algebraic sense. So there will always be some parameter, if necessary, when necessary, there will always be some small parameter, h bar or something, and convergence will not be in an analytic sense, but in the sense of power series in h bar. Okay? And the second convention is, so if you have a finite set A and a letter Z, I will write Z sub A to be essentially the column vectors whose entries are Z sub I, where I is in A. And let's agree that every variable comes with a dual, so variables come in paired, and the dual of a Latin letter is the corresponding Greek letter. So zeta sub A is the collection of all the duals of Z sub I, which are the zeta I's. Okay? And this extends. So the dual of y is always eta, the dual of b is always beta, the dual of a is always alpha, the dual of x is always xi. Okay? And now, let me tell you how to, again, this is again baby material. At baby material level, how do you pack? Here is a map which packs maps between polynomial rings. So if you have a homomorphism, linear homomorphism, not multiplicative, from a polynomial ring in the variables z sub a to a polynomial ring in the variable z sub b, I'll tell you how to convert it into a power series in the variables Greek zeta sub a and z sub b. So basically the dual variables of a into the variables of b. Okay? So it's really, really easy. Suppose you have such a map L, a homomorphism from polynomials in ZA to polynomials in ZB. I will construct a power series, a calligraphic L, as follows. So it's just a generating series of the values of L. So I will look at any value of L, so I'll evaluate L on ZA to the power N, and what I mean by that, so N is not a single index, but a multi-index, so it's in the natural numbers to the power A, and then that really stands for the monomial corresponding to this multi-index, and then I want to make a generating series out of this, so I'll multiply it by a zeta a to the power n, and divide by n factorial, because I don't know, we're mathematicians, and what mathematicians like n factorial, and that's the generating series. A different way to say it is to say that, so I mean, really L is a linear map, so you can put the zeta n's, the zeta a to the n inside, okay, and then you see that this is just a formula for an exponential. So this is L evaluated on the exponential of the Greek letters paired with the Latin letters. And that's what I call calligraphic L. And another silly convention is that I think of the Greek variables as happening on the left of L and the Latin variables as happening on the right of L. That has no meaning whatsoever in the formal sense. Okay? But you'll see in a minute that it does have a meaning. Okay, and then this is actually, this calligraphic G, the generating series map, is in fact an isomorphism. So if you have an L, a generating series, you can read out the operator from it, namely G inverse of a series evaluated on a polynomial P is you take this polynomial and you replace all the Latin letters in it by differentiations with respect to the corresponding Greek letters, evaluate it on L, and compute it at the Greek letters equal to zero. And basically, you know, if you want, right, if think of a monomial. If the polynomial here, P, was a monomial, z to the 7, you want to know what's L of z to the 7, you need to look at the coefficient of zeta to the 7. You do it by differentiating with respect to zeta 7 times and evaluating at zeta equals to 0. Again, this is baby material. Okay? But anyway, so homomorphism between polynomial algebras make a category. I can compose them. So let me tell you how to compose the corresponding generating series. And again, it's baby material. So if you have a homomorphism L from polynomials in A to polynomials in B, another homomorphism M from polynomials in B into polynomials in C, then the generating series of their composition, this symbol means composition done in the right order, meaning from left to right, as opposed to circle, which is meant to confuse students. But you're not students, so there's no reason to confuse us. Okay? So you take the generating series of L. On the right, it has lots of Latin letters. You take the generating series of M. On the left, it has lots of Greek letters. You basically pair them. And this is, it follows in it. It's really baby material. So pairing them means you replace the Latin letters here with differentiations with respect to the Greek letters. The Greek letters appear here. And then you substitute zeta equals to zero. Okay? Here is a graphical way to see it. Basically, if you have L and it has monomials coming to the left, but these are Latin, and it also, sorry, Greek, and it also has variables coming to the right, and these are Latin, sorry, these are Latin, and you have M, and it has its Greeks to the left and its Latins to the right. The way you compose is you turn these into differentiations with respect to those. Evaluate. But that just means sum over all ways of pairing the variables that appear here with the variables that appear here. So that's composition. You with me? Okay, good. So let's do a few examples. Okay? So first of all, what's the generating series of the identity map? Well, the general rule was that the generating series of a map is you apply the map to the exponential, thinking of the zetas as constants. So basically, you know, you expand this, this becomes a power series in the z's, and then you evaluate. Okay? But so now suppose I have the identity map from polynomials in yax into polynomials in ya and x. Why did I choose these? I don't know. Okay? So you have to apply the identity to the exponential of the pairing between ya and x and the corresponding Greek letters. And the result is, well, applying the identity map does nothing, so you just get the exponential of the pairing. And if you look at it, this is the exponential of a quadratic, right? If you look, if you think about it as a function of all the variables, Greek and Latin, this is a quadratic. It's a quadratic that is linear in both Greek and in Latin, but still it's a quadratic. And the exponential of a quadratic is Gaussian. So hence the word Gaussian that appeared at some point. I think it appeared, wasn't it in abstract? If it wasn't, then it will appear later. Okay, next. So I care about non-commutative products, but let's do the commutative product. So the commutative product is a map, M, going from polynomials in Z, tensor polynomials in Z, into polynomials in Z. But let me introduce a few conventions. When I take the tensor product of two space, of several spaces, I think of each factor as having a name, okay? Rather than ordering them from left to right, I think of the factors as having names. So this means polynomials in Z in tensor factor I. This means polynomials in Z in tensor factor J. And then the multiplication map is really MIJK because it maps into polynomials in Z in tensor factor K. But you see, polynomials in Z in tensor factor I is really polynomials in a variable Zi. This is polynomials in a variable Zj, and the tensor product is at polynomials in two variables, Zi and Zj. So really, Mijk can be thought of as a map from polynomials in two variables, Zi and Zj, into Zk, and the map is actually the map that maps Zi on its own to Zk and Zj on its own to Zk. So basically, it's the map given by Zi and Zj going to Zk. Hence, the generating function is Mijk applied to the exponential of the pairing. Zi and Zj both become Zk, so the result is this, and this is again the exponential of a quadratic. So at the end, I will want to ask myself, how do I compose Gaussians? Okay? Next. I have in mind coalgebras as well. So here's the coproduct ijk going from polynomials in Z into polynomials in Z tensor polynomials in Z. Or really polynomials in Zi into polynomials in Zj and Zk. And the standard coproduct on polynomials is the map which maps Z into Z tensor 1 plus 1 tensor Z. And in my language, it's the map which maps Zk into, so this is Z in the first factor, so it's Zi. This is Z in the second factor, so it's Zj. And I hope this is what I wrote here. It isn't. I meant Zk. Okay. Ah, and this was ZI, sorry. Okay? But anyway, the generating series is you apply this silly map to the exponential of the pairing, you get ZI times ZJ plus ZK, and again it's a Gaussian. Let's do a slightly more complicated example. So let's do the Heisenberg algebra. So let H be the Heisenberg algebra in two letters X and Y, meaning it's the free algebra generated by X and Y, modulo the relations that the commutator of X and Y is a certain constant H bar. Okay? Where H bar, again, is just a constant. Now, let OI be the PBW ordering map. Physicists would call it the normal ordering map. Okay? So it's the map from polynomials in xi and yi, so I've already made it live in tensor factor I. Okay? So it's the map from polynomials in xi and yi into hi, which plants the x's before the y's. So I don't know even how to write it, right? The map maps x to the 3, y to the 7, to x to the 3, y to the 7, except this is an element of the polynomial ring, and this is an element of the Heisenberg algebra. Okay? And now I want to study the multiplication map from hi tensor hj into hk, but the way I do it is that I compose with a PBW map on the left, so the ordering map OI tensor OJ, which maps polynomial in four variables into this, and compose on the right with the inverse PBW map, which maps the Heisenberg algebra to polynomials. Okay? So I claim that the generating series is the exponential of lambda, where lambda is given by this formula. But again, notice that it's a quadratic. And in fact, it's a quadratic, well, like the quadratics of before, well, this is really the quadratic that represents multiplication, but it's slightly perturbed or slightly modified. And it's modified by a Greek term. So I can't just live with things that are linear in Greeks and quadratics. I also need Greek and Greek. Okay? So proofs. So proof one. If you have seen it in physics, you may have seen the vial form of the canonical commutation relations, and it says that e to the eta y e to the xi x is equal to e to the minus h bar eta xi times e to the xi x e to the h. Basically, the cost of commuting e to the eta y across e to the xi x is the exponential of the scalar e to the negative h bar eta xi. And now we compute. I want to compute the generating series of Heisenberg multiplication. To do this, I need to feed the exponentiated pairing into ordering multiplication and inverse ordering. Well, this ordered is this. Basically, I take the variables in order. Then I take this and multiplying, but multiplying just well, strictly speaking, this product lives in the tensor product of two Heisenberg algebras, and now I multiply, so it lives in one algebra, but it's the same expression, and then I unorder. Then I need to unorder, I need to apply the inverse ordering map. But this is not yet in order, because I have a y before an x here. So I need to flip these two terms, and the cost is this vial factor, which is written here, and then what I'm left with is just the ordinary product, and, well, this is what the formula asserted QED. Okay? Proof two. So I find a faithful three-dimensional representation of the Heisenberg algebra, but I also need to represent the scalars. So x hat will be the matrix written here, y hat will be the matrix written here. I have to change the 1 here to an h bar to have the right scalar. And the what represents this the constants is the matrix written here. And if you don't believe me that this has the right commutation relation, this is, by the way, written in computer code. This is input for Mathematica. So I input into Mathematica x hat dot y hat minus y hat dot x hat. Is it equal to h bar times the constant? And likewise, does the constant commute with x? Does the constant commute with y? I hit enter, and Mathematica outputs true, true, true. So these matrices are the correct matrices. And then I tell Mathematica, let lambda be the thing that I said it, that I want it to be. And what I need to check, if you go back, I need essentially, I think it's still on the screen, I need to check that, okay, that this product of elements is equal to this product of elements. This is the part, that was the hard part. That was the part that used the Weyl commutation relations. So I need to check that this product is equal to that product. So the product on the left is, well, I define E to be matrix exponentiation. So the product on the left is E of x bar times psi I, exponential of y bar times y I. Basically, this is the product on the left. And I check if it's equal to, so how do I find out what's this product? So this is the, if you look at it, this is the derivative, this is e to the c times the derivative of lambda with respect to c. This is e to the x times the derivative of lambda with respect to x. So I ask the computer to compute this product. I hit enter, the computer says true, and the theorem is proven. Okay, the reason I went through it in some detail is because I'm going to do it in a slightly more complicated case right now. Okay? Are you still with me? So far we've only had Gaussians. I'm going to go outside of Gaussian world now. Okay? So, but first I need to introduce an algebra. So this will be the algebra I will be playing with for much of the rest. And it's called CU. I don't know why. So here's the wrong way to see the algebra. The algebra is GLN with a funny basis, or GL2, sorry, with a funny basis. This is wrong, but it works for introduction. So, namely, the basis is Y is 0, 0, epsilon, 0, B is 0, 0, negative epsilon, and so on. And let's check the commutation. I claim that this algebra has some commutation relations. So let's check that A times X minus X times A is equal to A times Y minus Y times A, Y times A is negative Y, and so on. Maybe the most interesting commutation relation is that X times Y minus Y times X is B plus epsilon A. Again, I hit enter. The computer prints true, 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 so this commutation relation holds. But notice that the algebra didn't make sense if epsilon was equal to zero. But the commutation relations do make sense when epsilon equal to zero. So let's define the algebra CU to be, let's define the algebra SL2 plus of epsilon to be the Lie algebra generated by Y, B, A, and X subject to the commutation relations that I wrote before. And if you look at, but this commutation relation makes sense even when epsilon is equal to zero. So when epsilon equals to zero, this is not GL2. Okay? And if you look at it, you'll see that T, which is epsilon A minus B, in fact, it's the identity matrix in the GL2. But anyway, regardless, T, which is equal to epsilon A minus B, is central. And if epsilon is invertible, then SL2 plus epsilon is isomorphic to SL2 plus an extra abelian factor. Okay? And hence the name SL2 plus. Okay? It's SL2 plus another factor. And then let CU be the universal enveloping algebra of CU.
of this SL2 plus epsilon, and let CM for C multiplication be the composition written here. So basically you take the multiplication in CU and compose it with the ordering maps. And then so now I have a map from a polynomial ring in 8 variables into a polynomial ring in 4 variables, and I'm asking myself, what is the generating series? Answer, I claim that this is the generating series. Okay? I have never understood this formula. I don't know where it's coming from. I don't care. I only care about its properties. So you don't need to understand it either. Okay? But let's verify it. First of all, it's of the right form. It has 8 Greek letters in it. Eta I, alpha I, eta j, 8 Greek letters. It has 4 Latin letters, yk, bk, ak, xk. And what I need to verify is that it satisfies a certain identity. Sorry, the generating series is the exponential of this lambda. So I need to check that a certain identity. I check it just as before in a representation. The representation I already wrote, so all I have to check is that the corresponding product of exponentials, a corresponding equality of a product of exponentials. So I enter it into the computer, hit enter, get true, and this is the proof. And the truth is, the way I found this formula is I knew there would be some such formula, so instead of putting the partial derivatives of lambda, I put here an unknowns. And then I got, instead of true, I got an equation, and I asked the computer to solve this equation, and the solution of the equation is what is written here. I have no idea what this formula means, I don't care. Okay? What I do care is that if I expand it as a power series in epsilon, so again, this completely doesn't make sense in the GL2 thinking of the algebra. Okay? Because I'm doing things near epsilon equals to zero where the algebra doesn't make sense. But still, if I expand it as a... But the algebra does make sense, sorry, as GL2, as the isomorphism with GL2 doesn't make sense. But the algebra does. So anyway, if I expand this formula as a power series in epsilon, and I regard the lower half of the alphabet, so A and B and alpha as beta, and alpha and beta, if I regard them as constants, then the result, I claim, is a docile perturbed Gaussian with respect to the other variables. Now, what's a docile perturbed Gaussian? So it's the exponential of some lambda, where lambda is a quadratic plus a constant, which just means some constant prefactor, plus a power series in epsilon, where the coefficient of epsilon to the k is docile, which means it has, as a polynomial in all the other variables, it has a bounded degree, namely the degree of pk is less than 2k plus 2. So pk will be a polynomial in x, y, xi, and eta, but it has to be bounded, of a bounded degree. So again, let's check it. So I ask the computer to expand lambda, and now look at every term here, and it matches. So first of all, the term not proportional to epsilon is, well, this is a quadratic, this is a quadratic, again, because this exponential is constant. This is a quadratic, this is a quadratic, which also mixes Greeks, but that's fine. So basically, that's a quadratic. Now, the term proportional to epsilon, the highest power that appears here is 4, right? This is a polynomial of degree 4. A few other polynomials of degree 4 appear here, but that's allowed. Now, the term proportional to epsilon squared, I'm allowed to have powers up to 6, and I don't know, there must be someone here at power 6, but no more. Okay? Good. And one last example, which I will not do in detail.
I'm sorry.
Yeah?
Was it important that you did lower and then it was relatively upper? Like, is it symmetric in upper and lower half?
It's symmetric in upper and lower half, and I will return to it in a moment. It's actually, yeah, I'll get to it in a moment. Okay. The picture is so not focused that I can't even see how much time I have left. Okay. Good. So another standard example that appears in Lie algebras. So if you have a semi-simple Lie algebra, there is always a quadratic Casimir in it. This is essentially the metric of the Lie algebra, or the inverse of the metric. And often in quantum algebra, you need to exponentiate it. So you get an element in U of G tensor U of G. But it's the exponent, but elements of the algebra become Latin letters, and you end up exponentiating a Latin tensor Latin, and then what you get is a quadratic in Latin letters. Or maybe perturbed, because this is not a commutative exponential, but the point is that you get, you end up getting Latin-Latin quadratics as well. So you need to worry about all types of quadratics. And the same, by the way, so e to the t is a variant of the R matrix, if you've seen quantum invariants. So R matrices also turn out to be Latin-Latin exponentials. So I really need all types. Okay, and now I can make a definition. So definition, the category of docile perturbed Gaussian differential operators is the category whose objects are finite sets. Notice that there are footnotes. I'll get to the footnotes later. The footnotes, I mean, this definition is correct, but the footnotes make it more correct. Okay? So, and the morphism from a set A to a set B is the set of all perturbed quadratics in the variables Greek letters for A, Latin letters for B, and an extra variable epsilon, which is the perturbation parameter, in such a way that omega is a scalar, omega is a scalar, Q is a quadratic which is independent of epsilon, and I actually want it to be small in some technical sense, so maybe there should be some h bar and it should be multiplied by h bar, but we have this agreement that everything converges, you don't need to think about it. And P is a docile perturbation, so P is sum of epsilon to the k, p to the k, where the degree of pk is bounded by 2k plus 2. And then compositions in this category is, composition of L and M is like the composition of power series like the composition of generating series. Namely, you take L and you replace all the Latins in it by differentiations with respect to Greeks, apply to M, substitute zeta, the Greeks are equal to 0. Okay? It's not obvious that this is again an element of Dopendo. This requires a proof. But let's do it in a minute later. First of all, so what? Why should you care? So the reason you should care is because the standard way to do computations in quantum algebra, or also in Lie algebras, such computations, is to work in a finite dimensional representation. And if you have a complicated situation, a big knot with lots of strands, you end up looking at the high tensor power of the representation in order to do computations. And the problem is that a representation to the power n has dimension which explodes. It's an exponential in n. Okay? So computations are very, very hard. However, if you look at Dopendo up to a fixed power epsilon, then, first of all, the space of quadratics, well, a quadratic in n variable, or two n variables, if you think of both the Greeks and the Latins, is just a matrix, an n by n matrix of entries. So the number of quadratics grows really slowly. And likewise, the number of polynomials in the variables, if you bound the degree, also grows slowly. So the sizes of the spaces of morphisms are small, and whatever composition is going to be, it's going to be fast. And that's the, in a nutshell, why this is good. Okay? Good. But now I have to tell you how to do compositions. Okay? So let's try to compose two morphisms. But first of all, if you have a quadratic, I've already made this distinction, right? You can always decompose it into the E part, which is a Greek-Latin part, the F part, which is a Greek-Greek part, and the G part, which is a Latin-Latin part. And then a morphism, schematically, symbolically, looks like, well, it goes from A to B. I put the Greek letters on the left, the Latin letters on the right. It has a constant part, omega. It has a quadratic going from Latin to Greek, from Greek to Latin. It has a Greek-Greek part, a Latin-Latin part, and a perturbation part, which depends on epsilon, and there are some rules on how the dependence can go, but in principle, it's some mess that confuses Greeks and Latin, but it looks like this. Okay? So suppose I have two such things, and I want to compose them. Well, what is composition? Composition is you sum over all ways of pairing the Latin ends here with the Greek ends here. Except the picture is slightly telling you a lie, because what I want to compose is the exponentials of all of these things, of Q1 and the exponentials. But you know, what's an exponential? I think I learned it when I was in first year of university. It's something like 1 plus x times x over 2 plus x times x over 3 factorial. And so basically it means you take either 0 copies of x or 1 copy of x or 2 copies or 3 copies plus combinatorial factors. But this really means that there isn't just one G line here, but there are many, 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 many. And you can compose them with many, many, many F lines here and E, and many, many, many E lines here and many, many P things. Okay? So now, suppose I want to find what is the E term of the output. The E term of the output will come out from those contractions that start on the left, go through the middle and end on the right. How would you get these? So the simplest way is to go from here to here, contract an end from here to an end from here, and go all the way across. So the E term of the output will have a contribution that looks like E1 plus E2. But then maybe also you could go from here to an F, to a G, and now that we're out in G, you can go out with an E. So the next term will be E1 times F2 G1 E2. But you could spend more time in the middle. You could go from here to here, to here, to here, to here. Basically, you can cycle an arbitrary number of times through the FG machine and then come out. So, really, you get E1 times sum k goes from 0 to infinity F2 G1 to the power k times E2. But this is a geometric series. So the sum is 1 over 1 minus this. And hence, the composition law is that the E of the output is E, well, is whatever is written here. Okay? Likewise, similar things for the f of the output. So for the f of the output, the only thing you can do, well, I don't know, to go from here to here, so to go from the input back to, so from the left back to the left, you either go direct, or you go through an e-term, then you cycle around a bit, and then you go through an e-transpose, hence what is written here. Likewise for g, and then there is a fun term, which is a bit hard to understand, but basically, there are also cyclings around the cycles, as opposed to, basically, you go around the loop and then you eat your own tail. And this gives scalar contributions, and with some thought, you find out that the scalar contribution is the determinant of the identity minus F2G1 inverse. Hence, this is the new scalar of the output. By the way, this in itself is fun. So I bet you didn't know that you can make a category out of Gaussians and with such a funny composition law. It's also mathematically useful because when you set epsilon equals to zero in everything that I will tell you, what remains is the Alexander polynomial. And this turns the Alexander polynomial into an invariant of tangles with very easy and simple-minded compositions, but that belongs to a different lecture, not today's. Okay? But yet, I still have to tell you about the p of the output. Right? So far, epsilon was equal to zero. Now I have to look at the coefficient of epsilon to the k. So how are you going to get epsilon to the k? You're going to take some epsilons from here, some epsilons from here, in all possible ways. Namely, you're going to take some number of p1s, some number of p2s, so you'll have a number of p1s, a number of p2s, and then you'll have to contract them. So some contractions will go from, well, basically, that's what the contractions would look like, except even the contractions might go a number of times through the FG machine. So I indicated a trip through the FG machine by a bar. So this goes twice through the FG machine. These are Feynman diagrams. If you've seen Feynman diagrams, that's what they are. Okay? So basically, the composition involves Feynman diagrams whose vertices are P1 and P2, and where the propagator is I minus F2G1 inverse. Okay? That's all I have to say. Okay? It's a little bit of a combinatorial exercise to check that docility is preserved. So somehow these contractions reduce the degree in just the right amount so that if 1 and 2 were docile, then the composition is again docile. Okay. Are you with me? Now come the footnotes. So the footnotes are, well, if you look at these formulas, well, they are okay with respect to the lower half of the alphabet and with respect to the upper half of the alphabet, but not jointly. So the footnotes are that really each variable should have a weight which is 0, 1, or 2, and you always have that the weight of a variable plus the weight of the dual is 2. Second, when I said scalars, when I said sets, the sets could really be graded sets, which means disjoint unions of sets that have a 0 part, a 1 part, and a 2 part. Then, when I said scalars, I really mean arbitrary power series in the weight zero variables. And then there are a few further rules that are, best not thought of in the first iteration. But the bottom line is that with the footnotes in place, this is a docile perturbed Gaussian. So like this thing here, with respect to the weights, that the upper half is weight 1, and the lower half has weights as written there. So A is weight 2, B is weight 0, alpha is weight 0, B beta is weight 2, and you, if you want, you can put weight negative 2 to epsilon. Indeed, I don't know, over here, this is a 1, 1, so this is a quadratic of weight 2, and the coefficient is the exponential of e to the minus alpha j, but alpha is weight 0, so it's allowed. And you can check that the composition law actually survives these modifications. So, in fact, when you want to compose real things or complicated things, you actually do it in two steps, where you first do the degree 1 variables and then the degree 0, 2 variables. Okay? And it's, again, I'm running out of time, so I will not go through it. I'll just tell you that it's analogous in linear algebra to the fact that in linear algebra you can actually solve nonlinear equations sometimes. So if you have an equation of the form ax is equal to a, and b of x times y is equal to b, that's not a linear system, but still you can solve it by solving and substituting. It's roughly similar. You do it in two steps. Okay. I think I'm... maybe I'll skip the... I think I have 4 minutes, so I'll skip the things I don't know. Maybe you can read them. And just tell you that a bigger theorem. So the theorem is that everything of value relative to the algebra CU, which I've introduced before, and its quantization QU, if you don't know what's quantization, you scroll up a bit and you see it's written in a completely explicit formula, a completely explicit coefficient. It doesn't matter, okay? It really doesn't matter. So everything of value belongs to this category. Therefore, all the compositions of all the things of value belongs to this category. Okay? Things of value are the R matrix, namely the value of a crossing in odd theory. The caps and the caps, the product which allows you to multiply, put crossings together. The coproduct which allows you to double components. The antipode, even associators and twist elements, all sorts of things are basically everything in quantum algebra is Dopecto for these two algebras. And the corollary is that, well, if you want an arbitrary tangle and you want its invariant, well, you just get it by taking a number of copies of R and multiplying it using a number of copies of the multiplication tensor. So the result is again Dopecto. So actually the corollary at the end is that there are lots of polytime computable, very well behaved, though I don't have time to tell you in what sense, and very strong knot invariants. Here is a statement about how strong they are. And here is the beginning of a table of values. If you go to the PDF version of the handout, the table continues. And if I had a couple more minutes, and I do, I would tell you that the story goes on beyond SL2, beyond the two algebras that I told you about. So first of all, what is the story? The story is, really, we find a path in the world of Lie algebras. This is this path SL2 epsilon. And we expand quantum invariants relative to a point in the path which is actually not a semi-simple Lie algebra, namely the point where epsilon equals to 0, which is a solvable algebra. So we expand semi-simple around solvable, and really solvable, the name says it right, means that you can solve, and hence we solved. Okay? But this phenomena is general. Namely, if you have a semi-simple Lie algebra, let's say SLN, for the purpose, So SLN can be, or really SLN plus a second copy of the Cartan, that's the plus thing, is the direct product of the upper Borel and the lower Borel, so the upper triangular matrices and the lower triangular matrices. And all the information is already in the upper triangular matrices because, well, there is a bracket from upper triangular to upper triangular, so there is a bracket on upper triangular matrices, but also upper triangular matrices are the dual of lower triangular matrices. So there is a dual bracket on upper triangular, and that's the co-bracket, which we call delta. So delta goes again from, it corresponds to the bracket of the lower triangular matrices, but it really is a map from upper triangular to upper triangular, tensor upper triangular. And there is a reconstruction method. The reconstruction method is called the Drinfeld double. So SLN plus an abelian factor is the double of the upper triangular matrices using a bracket on a co-bracket. But now you can multiply the co-bracket by epsilon, and that's what I did in the case of SL2 to get the algebra that exists. And now I am a minute after time, and that's the traditional time in which one stops, so I'll stop. Okay. Yeah, let's... Quick questions. Yes.
Do you fear there's no twist there? Is there any hope of getting like a within category or something that ultimately occurs?
You
where are we going and where are we going?
Sure.
I can find it. But something else. Maybe we can.
Yes, but it's a long story.
Well, that actually got a question, but it might be long.
Is it more than a joke?
It's
more than hope, but it's a long story.
Yeah.
So you can get manifold invariants out of this business. I haven't done it yet. They are actually not very strong. These are strong knot invariants, not terribly strong manifold invariants. That's the answer. I mean, now, and it's not done in the sense of written or computed in practice. You know, if I had a time for a prequel, I would give you the prequel for this talk, which would be why this type of knot invariance is valuable to knot theory. So I actually care about knot invariance, not about manifold invariance.
So I was wondering, can you say a little bit more about the last theorem where you said that everything is Topengo?
Yes.
So Topengo is a category, right? So what do you mean by saying that everything is, like,
Matrix, so all of these things, okay, so multiplication is a map from U tensor U into U, which corresponds to polynomial tensor, so that's clearly an element of Topengo. But this is an element of the algebra tensor itself, which is like a homomorphism from the empty tensor power to the algebra. So basically this corresponds to the input set being empty.
Is R matrix not a completion of that? It's a good idea.
That was we had a gentle agreement in the beginning of the class. No, that's fine. The answer is yes. You need some other small parameter, h bar, and you have it. And everything is in the sense of power series of h bar, in h bar, and then it's fine.
Less time to go again. But before, like, do you want to get dinner?
You have to decide if you're inviting me for dinner.
No, I've invited you for dinner.